Lecture 29. Language Starts Over. Creoles, Part 2.
It will help us to take a look at an individual Creole or two to see how these languages work, and to see that even though inevitably, because they tend to shave away the prefixes and the endings that the language that gave them their words had, they seem kind of like baby talk on first glance, that they're not, and that they have complexities of their own. And we'll also see that these languages are interesting examples of how language and social history can interact and create different kinds of results. So, for example, throughout the course, I've been making brief reference to something called Saramaccan, and it's time to realize what Saramaccan is. There was, of course, a slave trade that was going on in the Caribbean and the surrounding region, and this began in a real way in the 1600s. And one of the places that was settled and farmed in this way was Suriname, which is in South America, on the Caribbean coast of South America. And it is, in terms of its ecology and location, basically the Caribbean, although it happens not to be an island. And the English settled this region first, and they brought slaves there. It was one of their earliest colonies that thrived in this region. And so the slaves were exposed to English. After that, the Dutch came and took over the country, and the Dutch ran Suriname until 1975, and so then Dutch ended up playing a role in the mix. And in the meantime, there were Portuguese Jewish people who were fleeing the Inquisition and had made quite a trip, most recently up through Brazil and then French Guiana next door to Suriname, and they came most likely with slaves, and in any case, they certainly bought slaves once they got to Suriname. And so there were some plantations where the Portuguese ran the plantations, but a lot of their slaves had started learning Western languages under the English. So as a result, Saramaccan has a kind of hybrid European vocabulary. The basis of it is English, but then there's an awful lot of Portuguese in it too because of this history. Then, what's important about Saramaccan is that there were two creoles that formed in Suriname. One of them was formed by the slaves who stayed on the plantations, this being mostly the ones that were run by the English and then the Dutch. That is Sranang, which I talked about. Many slaves, unsurprisingly, because by most reports, slavery wasn't much fun. And so people tended to kind of run away when they could. And Suriname lent itself to that because there was a rainforest and you can hide. So many slaves ran and they founded communities in the rainforest. And the communities thrived and they survived to this day. The people in these rainforest communities developed a different language than the ones who stayed on the plantations. And as it happens, most of the people who ran away were from the Portuguese plantations. So Saramaccan is related to Sranang, but it's very different. It is not mutually intelligible with it. And it's the more African of the Creoles, because here were Africans living in their own society, where instead of having any pretense of trying to speak English, they were just speaking a new language of their own, built up from the amount of English and Portuguese that they had learned on the coast, and then expanded into a language of their own. Much of that expansion was based on West African structures rather than anything in the languages spoken by their former oppressors. So, here is an example, an audio clip, of one sentence of Saramaccan. It goes something like this. So that was a sentence of Saramaccan. And one thing that you see in that sentence is the incredibly mixed nature of the vocabulary of this Creole. There are words from five different languages in that one very ordinary sentence. And so, the de as in debitakaya yeyeta, they called her yeyeta. The de is from they. And then the wa. The sentence begins with na henwe wandakate, and what that means is, well, one day a long time ago. Well, the wandaka is one day, and the wa is from one, and so that's from English. Wandaka is one day, daka is from Dutch's word for day, dag. Then it's nohenwe wandakate, so one day long ago, dimuye mifeng, the woman child of her, her girl, debitakanya yeyeta, they called her yeyeta, so they called her girl yeyeta. Well, the word muye, dimuye mi, muye is woman, and that's from Portuguese mulher. And actually the mi, muye mi, the mi is from menino from Portuguese, which means child. So muye mi is a Portuguese word, although Portuguese itself would not put mulher, menino together like that. And then there's this we, and so nohenwe wantakate. Well, if we break that down, make it slower, it's nohenwe wantakate. Well, the we is from the language Fongbe, and that's just a little marker that gives a kind of emphasis. Then the te is from Kikongo. Kikongo is spoken in Angola on the west coast of Africa. So all those words come from different languages. Obviously, Saramaccan speakers are not thinking about that, but it just shows that this is a language which was born amidst the intersection of many different people. Now, there's a sound system in Saramaccan, and it's not the simple pidgin one that I mentioned. So there's more than a, e, I, o, u in the vowels, for example. So we have in our fragment, for example, nohenwe wandakate. Now, if we slow that down, it's nohenwe wandakate. So there are two different of what we might call e's. There's te, and then there's nohenwe. There's an e, and there's an e. And so those are two different E's instead of there being just one. There's also a sound O and an A, and they're very important in conveying different meanings. So in Saramaccan, instead of having A, E, I, O, U, what you have is A, E, E, I, O, A, U. That is the kind of vowel system that an older language that's been developed without any kind of interruption often has. Then Saramaccan also is a tonal language. And so Saramaccan, unlike English or Portuguese, uses the pitch that you utter a syllable on to indicate meaning to an extent. It doesn't use this to nearly the extent that, say, Chinese does, but it is there. So, for example, if you say kai, then that means to fall. If you say kai, then that means to call. And so there's a difference between the two. If you say da, then it means give. If you say da, then that means to be. And so there are various pairs like that in the language. And so it's not that every word is distinguished by a tone in that way, but there are various pairs like that. And in general, there are aspects of the way these tones or pitches work that even interact with other aspects of grammar. So this is a language that has tones in it as well. No pidgin would have tones, but this is a real language, and so it has tones. Then those verbs to be, like da. Saramaccan's verbs to be are kind of subtle. So, for example, you say, mi da gadu, I am God, and da is your verb to be. Now, if you're learning Saramaccan, you would assume that if you say, mi da gadu, then if you're going to say that I'm at home, and if you learn that awosu is at home, and you've managed to wrap your head around the counterintuitive fact that mi means I, then if you want to say I am at home, you'd think that it would be mi da awosu. But it isn't. That would actually create laughs among Saramaccan speakers because there's a different verb to be if you're talking about where you are rather than what you are. So da only means that you and God are the same thing, a very specific meaning of being. But if you want to say I am at home, you say mi de awosu, and that's for being at. So then you think you've got it, and you figure there's what you are and where you are. There's da, and there's de. Now, that's a distinction that English does not make, that Portuguese does not make. Actually, many languages in the world do. Saramaccan's one of them. But you still wouldn't be out of the woods yet. Because then, if you want to say something like, I am an animal, Well, you assume that it's going to be, if you know that an animal is wambeti, and so a meat is what that actually comes from, wambeti. If you want to say that you are an animal, then you assume that it's going to be mi da wambeti, because if mi da gadu, then certainly mi da wambeti. Actually, it's mi de wambeti. Now, if you're an animal, clearly you're not talking about a location. An animal is not a parking lot. So why is it that they use de there instead of da? Well, what it is that in a way, if you're an animal, you are in the class of what animals are. It's one thing if you are God and God is you. But if you are an animal, then presumably there are a whole lot of other animals of which you are just one. You are in that class that is animals. Therefore, you de wambeti. The subtlety of Saramak in learning how to use the verbs to be. If nobody told you that beforehand, you could spend a while kind of confused as to where they use da and where they use de. There's some other little complications in there. So there's that one. Or Saramakan can be even more subtle. It's one of the joys of being a linguist to figure out these sorts of things when you're dealing with something that hasn't been seen before. So let's say that you are talking about pushing a happy little dog into the water from a deck of the Titanic. So, you know, there is actual film of people before the ship pulled out walking their dogs on the deck. And I remember thinking, wouldn't it have been kind of funny if you had pushed one of those dogs out into the water? I'm kind of sick sometimes. So imagine if you were on the ship and you just pushed it out and it went down in the water. Let's assume it was saved. But anyway, so if you wanted to say that in Saramakan, and I asked my Saramakan speaker, you know, I described that exact scene, including the Titanic, and I said, suppose you push that little dog into the water. And the way the sentence would come out is, I pushed the dog in the water, mi toto di dagu tue awata. Now, what's important, and I did not intend this, is that toto does not refer to the little dog in The Wizard of Oz. The word for push in Saramakan just happens to be toto. So, mi toto di dagu tue awata. So, I pushed the dog, boop, awata. Now, the awata is into the water. But then there's this tue. Listen again. Mi toto di dagu tue awata. Tue. There's this little thing in there. Now, if we zero in on tue, it turns out that what that is it comes from throw away. Tue. Okay, isn't that nice? But then again, it seems kind of redundant because you already pushed the dog in. So what do you mean you pushed him and threw him? Presumably, if you push him, once he's falling down, you can't grab him again and throw him, and really, that'd be kind of sadistic. Just the push is enough for the effect that we desire. And nevertheless, the way it goes word for word is I pushed the dog throwaway in the water. Now, one approach to finding something like that is to just assume that it's random and wave it away and move on to something that's easy. But then another approach is to think that little flutter in the data must mean something. There's a reason why he's sticking this tue in. And, you know, you can get somebody on another day. At first you think, is he tired? Like, is that just some piece of junk? And so you ask a week later, so Rohit, how? Remember we were talking about the little Scotty on the Titanic? Now let's push him into the water again. How do you say it? And there's mi toto dagu tue awata. And if you ask, and this is what's important about grammar, it's like, how do you use a and the? If you ask the person, what does tue mean? Well, he'll say, well, it means throw away. Yeah, but how come you say throw away again when you've already pushed the dog? And, you know, he'll smile. I cannot answer a question like that. They have no idea any more than we know why you say, well, he married a Portuguese woman when you've known the Portuguese woman all your life, so why are you using the indefinite So they don't know, and that makes it more interesting because that means that it's systematic and somehow it's underlying and you have something to discover and to talk about when you're doing a series of recordings. So what's tue? You have to find that in some other sentence. So I figured, well, it seems to have something to do with things going through the air or something like that. So we were in an ugly little room, and I balled up a piece of paper, and I threw it into the trash can. And I said, okay, so what did I just do? And he said, well, you mean how do you say throw the letter in? And I said, yeah, okay. And he said, well, you would say, vinde di bife tue. And so vinde is throw, then de beefy, which is from brief in Dutch, letter, throw the letter in. Vinde de beefy, throw the letter to it, throw it. Now this time it's even weirder because we're using a word for throw. Throw the letter throw away. Now, you can't just think, well, this is a non-Western language, and so they think it's cute to repeat things. There's a reason why that throwaway keeps coming in. So, I threw all sorts of sentences at him involving things being thrown away. And it turned out there were all sorts of things. You know, if a branch falls to the ground in a storm, it falls throwaway. If you're pouring syrup over pancakes, then you pour the syrup throwaway onto the pancakes. Turns out that what tuwe is that Saramaccan has this tick. It has this kind of, this certain anality. If something is being thrown and it's following some pathway, then you have to indicate that it finished that pathway. So you don't just throw Toto in the water, you throw him into the water. English has this too. So if you say, I push the dog in the water, now, we know what it means. It means that you were on the Titanic and you pushed the dog and it fell into the water. But technically, it could mean that you were in a bathing suit, you were in the water, and the dog was doing the doggy paddle alongside, and it came up, and you pushed it. And it's like, and you pushed it away. I pushed the dog while both of us were in the water. We know, really, generally, it would mean that you pushed him over the side. But in Saramaccan, there is no ambiguity because you pushed the dog. And if you threw him into the water with that two meaning kasplash, then you have to put due. If you pour the syrup over the pancakes, then when you pour it, well, it doesn't just go off into the ether, it hits the pancakes. Well, for us, we consider that obvious. If you say, I poured the syrup onto the pancakes, you don't, if I poured the syrup on the pancakes, you don't ask whether the syrup landed, nor do you say, do you mean that you were standing on the pancakes and then you poured syrup? You know that it means that you poured it while you were standing nowhere near on the pancakes and it hit them. We assume that it hit it, and if it didn't, it's an accident and you clean it up. But for them, if you pour it, you have to mention that it hit it. So it's the cat again. It's the way a cat noses into an obscure little place. We figure that difference between in and into the water is a quiet nuance we never thought about before. In Saramaccan, you can't speak the language without marking it, because if you don't mark it, then you're kind of speaking baby Saramaccan. So Saramaccan does not have conjugational paradigms, but if you push that little dog into the water, you better make it clear that that dog hit the surface. Or there's a question as to whether you were in the water with the dog, or if perhaps the laws of gravity stopped once you pushed that dog and it went flying through the air, barking desperately as everybody else went to their deaths on the ship. So that is grammar in Saramaccan. And so that's just to show that it's a language. It's a real language. It is not, at the end of the day, as complex as it says. But what this shows is that all languages are complex to some degree. There's no such thing as a simple language. Or if a language is truly ding-dong, romper-room, meat and potatoes simple, then it's a pidgin and it's not a real language. If it's a real language, it's got stuff in it. And so, since it's a real language, it undergoes all the same processes that we've seen that real languages undergo. So, for example, it changes over time. We have documents of Saramaccan from 200 years ago, and it's a very different language in some ways. So today, the word for call is kai. In 1789, it would have been kali, and so there was the L in it that we would expect. A sound change process made the L drop out between vowels, and so now it's kai. It used to be kali. That's what happens to languages over time. Saramaccan has dialects. There's a northern and a southern dialect. So the word for not, as in I'm not going, mi a waka, I'm not walking, is a in the north. But then in the south, it's a. And when I say a instead of a, I'm not rendering a the way Mo the bartender talks on The Simpsons. Alma, in Saramaccan, it's a. What I'm doing is an actual sound difference. Because, for example, in Saramaccan, da means to give, da means waterfall, so we're nasalizing it. And so it's ah in the north, then in the south it's very different, ah for not. Or there's mixture. So Saramaccan has encountered languages over time after it was formed. When the Dutch came and took over, suddenly Saramaccan started taking in Dutch words where once there had been English and or Portuguese words. So today, even though the basis of Saramaccan, in terms of its core words, is English and Portuguese, the numbers 3, 5, 9, 11, and 12 are from Dutch, because especially when you get into higher numbers, usually you're talking about something where it has to do with the wider world, and that means you're probably interacting with some Dutch person, and therefore those numbers tend to be from Dutch. So it's a language. It's a new language in many ways, but as soon as a language hits the ground, then it starts running. But what's interesting about these languages is how quickly they can emerge. In most cases, we can only guess. A great deal of ink has been spilled about what's called Creole Genesis Theory. Much of that ink spilled by me. But a lot of it is detective work, because we can't know. Very rarely was anybody moved to write down, the slaves in the fields are developing something which is a new language in its own right. Here are how the verbs pattern. You know, no one cared. And so we just have to infer from various sources. But sometimes a Creole has arisen at a time when, if cameras weren't on, newspapers were being written, or people who were there could be interviewed by the time they were 117, and we could ask them what went on. One of those situations was in Hawaii, or I get the feeling I'm supposed to say Hawaii. I hear that said often, so I'll say that once. Then I'll go back to saying Hawaii. So, it is apparent that in Hawaii, a Creole language developed basically in one generation. First, there was just a pidgin with people running around butchering English because there was no need to speak it any better. And then all of a sudden, boom, there was a language. And people were actually around to, in their untrained way, notice that something had happened. So, for example, in the late 1800s, American businesses established plantations in Hawaii. It's hot in Hawaii, it's fertile, and it's far away. So this is the kind of place where you can get a plantation-style economy going when you can't staff it with African slaves anymore, and in general, the notion of enslaving any indigenous person is now something that there is a moral advance beyond. So you're going to set up a situation where you can get some people to work much too hard under more formalized and legal conditions, and that was Hawaii in the late 1800s. The foremen were from Portugal, so here's another example of tiny little Portugal taking a dominant role. And the workers that they brought to the plantations were first from China, then from Japan, then there were a handful from Korea, and much more than a handful from the Philippines. So that very hybrid culture that we associate with Hawaii begins with this remarkable mixture of immigrant groups all on this one island. There was also a little bit of Puerto Rican ancestry in all of these people. Now, the first generation of workers, and this stuff was written down to an extent, and the first generation in the 70s, when people started studying this, were still around. They were very old, but the way they talked involved using their language in ways that often reflected their native languages, and in a very rudimentary way. And so, for example, kaukau meant eat, and there was one Filipino person who came at the pidgin stage, never really learned English. And what they were saying was, you could gather from context, it's better here than in the Philippines. Here you can get all kinds of food, but over there, there isn't any money. The way it came out in this pidgin English was, good dis one. So that's, it's better here than in the Philippines. Good dis one. And then here you can get all kinds of food. Kaukau any kind dis one. So that's it. You know, any kind of food this one. Then, Philippine island no good, no more money. So, we don't need to condescend and pretend that that's English. It isn't. That's somebody doing their best, just like we would sound just like that in Tagalog if we went to the Philippines and never really learned the language. A Japanese person says he bought my coffee, and the way they said it was, mi kape bai. And so that's mi coffee bai. He puts the verb at the end. Well, Japanese puts its verb at the end. But then you have a speaker from the Philippines. Their language was not Tagalog, it was Ilocano, very closely related. All the languages of the Philippines put their verb first. And so no surprise that when this person said he got married, he said, marry this one. And so it puts the verb first. So all these people are speaking English kind of the way they feel like it, and you can communicate on that level, especially if you don't communicate among yourselves that much. Most of the time, you're home speaking Japanese and Ilocano. But if you have kids, your kids are not going to continue in that lifestyle. The kids ended up playing with each other. The kids went to school together. And as we know, very young people tend not to quite feel the interethnic lines that one seems to pick up when one's an adolescent. So you have this fertile child situation where a new identity based on being a Hawaiian arose rather than being someone from Japan, someone from the Philippines, etc. And so as a result, the kids started all doing the same stuff. So even if your parents were Japanese, you weren't putting the verb at the end. Your parents were Filipino or from the Philippines, you weren't putting the verb at the beginning. Everybody was doing the same stuff. Now, if you're not a linguist, and modern linguistics was still in its infancy when all of this was happening at the turn of the last century, you're not going to notice the sorts of things that the pointy-headed person today who's trained in it is going to notice. But you get hints. So you read the newspaper at the time, and thank God, there's newspaper. In early Suriname, there's no newspaper. But now there's newspaper, and you read someone sniffing, the kids now all have this I been go way of talking. Well, I been go is interesting because that is the grammar of what is today Hawaiian Creole English. And what that means is that everybody is marking the past in the same way. They're all doing it. Now, a Japanese person could mark the past one way. A Filipino person might mark the past another way. But now all the kids are doing it. Or at one point someone says, and then there's this pidgin English that the kids are using. Now, the terminology is off because really the pidgin is what the adults are using in scientific terms. It has no structure. But if you're going to attribute it to the kids, then it means that the kids are all speaking something. And if you're not a linguist, you're not going to say, well, this is a Creole because it is a language with a full... You're just thinking, it's not English, so we'll call that pidgin. But it is something. And what that person is referring to is the Creole. So if you look at Hawaiian Creole English today, which nobody calls it without a PhD, then you see that it has a grammar. They buy, they buy. They bought, they been buy. They are buying, they stay buy. And so you stay within it, and so you are buying it. They will buy, they go buy. They were buying, they been stay by. Now that's what's interesting. These markers combine and in a certain order. So if they been by is they bought, and if they stay by is they are buying, well then what if they are buying but it's in the past? That's they were buying. So you combine the two. They been stay by. But what's important is that it's not they stay been by. It has to be they been stay by. If they will be buying, they go, they will, they stay, they are, well then they go stay by. And so you have this combinability. So it's very much a grammar. Hawaiians themselves sometimes are not aware that what they call pidgin is actually a language with structure and nuance. Certainly people in the education system have been very ambivalent towards it. There has been a whole outcry for a long time over the place of quote-unquote pidgin in Hawaiian society, very similar to the one over Ebonics that rears its head here about once every 20 years. Few people understand that it is not bad language. Then there's the whole issue of people not understanding how language relates to dialect, and then how you fit all of this into education. They're very rich issues. But Hawaiian, quote-unquote, pidgin is a Creole. And that seems to have happened among kids in just one generation. This was a thesis that was propounded starting in the 1970s by Derek Bickerton, who now specializes more in the general evolution of language and trying to trace how language began. It was a very controversial idea, but as data has mounted over the years, it's become clear that whatever the problems in the details of his argumentation here and there, that he was correct that a Creole which did not exist at point A existed at point B with a new bunch of kids. Today, nobody who speaks the pidgin survives, and so now we just have generations of people who speak Hawaiian Creole English. But what they're speaking is something that arose apparently because you will not stick with a pidgin if that's what you're presented with. These kids certainly spoke Japanese and Ilocano and Korean and Chinese at home. But then when they're with each other, the English that they were exposed to first was this halting English from their parents. Well, the fact is, that's not really enough. Now, these kids were going to school in English 5 days a week. So it's not as if they took this halting language of their parents and used nothing but that to build English. There was also the influence from the schools. Nevertheless, they certainly were not being taught this Creole in the schools. So it appears that on the one hand, they learned standard English in school, but then on the other hand, the language that they used among themselves casually was built up out of their parents' pidgin, seasoned with what they were getting in the schools. So Hawaiian Creole English is not as far from English as a Suwanang or Saramaccan is. But this is something they did because that pidgin isn't enough. If you're going to play and you're going to be a person and you're going to get your feet wet and you're going to play marbles, then you are going to speak in a more fluent way. So they created it. Certainly they didn't know it, but they did it spontaneously because full language is part of being human. So that is the story of Creoles.